You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Today we have a special episode for you. It is my privilege to introduce a speaker who is here on campus visiting the school to speak for our Constitution Day lecture, Secret Service Director Randolph Tex Allis. Director Allis graduated with a bachelor's from Texas A&M and a master's from the Naval War College. He has served in the Marines as a naval aviator, rising through the ranks before finally retiring as a major general. Among other things, while in the Marines, he served as a fighter pilot, an instructor at the U.S. Navy Fighter Weapons School, more popularly known as Top Gun, and commanding general of the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing during Operation Iraqi Freedom. Following his retirement from the military, he moved into leadership positions in the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, including serving as the agency's chief operating officer. He was named by the president to serve as director of the Secret Service in April 2017. And I can promise you, listener, that that is just a very small selection from Director Allis's distinguished career. So thank you, Director Allis, for joining us. I want to break this into sort of two sections. First, I want to ask you some questions about your military career, specifically the bigger picture stuff there, and then a few questions about what you do as director of the Secret Service. So, on the one side, you retired as a major general.
Is that right? I did. Yes.
Most Americans do not serve in the military and get kind of their view of what the military does from TV and the movies, for better or worse. So can you tell us, first of all, what is a general, and how is being a general different from, say, being a colonel, being a captain, being a lieutenant, being another officer, and if there's a difference between being a major general and being a brigadier general?
Right.
Go into that maybe too.
Right. So, sure. So, general officers are your most senior officers and leaders in the U.S. military. There are obviously different grades of generals. There's a brigadier general is the lowest, a one-star. A major general, which is what I was, is a two-star. Lieutenant general is a three-star, and then a full general is a four-star. And then the Navy has commencement ranks, rear admiral, lower half, rear admiral, upper half, vice admiral, and admiral, which are one, two, three, and four stars. And I would say the principal difference between general officers and colonels and below partly is there's a very sharp cutoff in selection criteria. So typically, your general officer ranks is going to constitute a very small percentage of your U.S. military forces. So they're your highest ranking officer. So actually getting selected is somewhat difficult. And then the other thing is the scope of responsibility goes up too. So for instance, in the Marine Corps, there was the ratio of generals to the rest of the force was about 1 to 1500, 1 to 1600. So your responsibilities are much larger from that standpoint. So I think, duty-wise, for generals, they're going to command your larger organizations, your aircraft wings, your divisions, your corps, your, field armies, if we would have such an occasion for that kind of thing. They're also your what are called combatant commanders, which the U.S. has divided the world into regions, Pacific, Atlantic, Central, I can't remember all the regions off the top of my head, Northern, and all these are commanded by what are called combatant commanders. They're all four-star generals or admirals, and they're the actual ones who employ our forces in combat. People don't understand that the actual services, the Marine Corps, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, are not the ones who order their folks into combat. It's actually the combatant commanders who work under the authority of the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of Defense being the duly constituted civilian authority that can order those kinds of things. So it's actually not done by a general, it's done by a civilian. That's why they call it civilian control of the military.
Sure.
But the responsibilities are at a much higher level as a general officer as opposed to something like a you know, a major or a lieutenant colonel, something like that, even though they can command fairly large organizations themselves. So a lieutenant colonel might be in charge of a battalion of 800 people. A colonel might be in charge of a regiment of, let's say, 4,000 or 5,000. But a general, that's a division commander, will have typically 15,000, 17,000 people as an organization. So much larger organizations.
On generalship in general, the difference then between what a general does and what other officers do is the scale of the command. Is that fair?
It's the scale and the responsibility.
Okay.
So the scale and the responsibility are much higher. And then you get certain additional legal authorities you don't have as a more junior officer. Those are primarily related to judicial authorities.
And so, what would that include?
Well, so if you're a colonel, you can convene a special court-martial that has certain legal authorities inside of it. As a general, you can convene a general court-martial, which is basically can basically try any crime up to capital crimes. And in a special court-martial, you can't do that. So there are authorities assigned to general officers that you don't get as a more junior officer.
And what was your command when you were a general?
My command as a general were two. It was the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab, which, as we talk about, scope was actually very small. It was only a few hundred. And then I was the commanding general of the Marine Aircraft Wing in Iraq. It was larger. It was about 6,000 or 7,000 people.
And what did you do there?
So in Iraq, we supported the Marine Expeditionary Force, which at that time was about 37,000 folks, both Army, Navy, and Marine Corps were in theater at that time, all under the command of General John Kelly, who was what we call the MEF, Marine Expeditionary Force Commander. So my job as the Air Wing Commander was to support all the operations supporting the Marines and the soldiers on the ground, in addition to all the logistics responsibilities of moving stuff back and forth across western Iraq, which is quite large.
And this was in early 2000s?
This would be 2008.
2008.
So I was actually there twice, once in 2003 when the country was invaded, and then later in 2008. Now in 2003 I was a colonel,
right.
In 2008 then I was a major general.
And yet another question you don't have to answer. Can you give us sort of your brief overview of what happened in Iraq? Where did things fall apart?
Well, I think early on it's well established. I don't think it's too much contention that there's a general lack of recognition that with the elimination of really all authority in Iraq, the actual security of the state was going to go downhill rapidly. And so what happened is that is, in fact, what happened. It started to degenerate, and you got elements coming into the mix there that are creating a counter, you know, not a counter government, but are opposing efforts by the Americans and also by the central government in Baghdad that we had set up to actually anything that we're trying to do. So we basically got an insurgency going, which now is involving the people of Iraq itself. So I think early on there was a lack of recognition of where the direction that was going. And then in time, there was the recognition that if you couldn't provide security for the people, then there was no hope they were going to cooperate with what you were trying to do. They can't. Their lives are on the line. So as that was recognized in the really 2005, 6, 7 time frame, and Petraeus was a big player in that in addition to General Mattis, that recognition helped the U.S. military condition its response to what was occurring in Iraq, and we approached the situation on the ground much more as an insurgency, as just a military occupation. And from that point forward, actually the least likely province they thought to turn would be Al-Anbar, which was the first province to turn and cooperate with the military and the Iraqi government. And a lot of that was we interfaced at the local level with the local tribal leaders and helped establish security in their cities, in their tribes, so they could actually function without intimidation by groups. At that time, it would have been al-Qaeda in Iraq, led by al-Zarqawi, who was a Jordanian.
Sure. Well, to turn a little bit into something more theological, again, most Americans do not serve in the military, which has its own ramifications
right.
for society. But Christians at least do encounter some form of authority with church elders. There any two positions of authority are going to have some similarities, service and responsibility and integrity and accountability and so on. But being a general and in a position of authority like that, and you have also served as an elder in a Baptist church, being in a position of authority like that, do those two positions relate to each other at all, or are they massively different? Where do you see similarities and contrasts there?
I see similarities in how you work with people and how you treat people. I would see those as the same. You know, you're obviously trying to treat people with respect. You know, you're trying to nurture them even in a military organization or even in the Secret Service. Same thing in a church. You're trying to grow them up in their relationship with the Lord. So I see those as similarities. The differences would be in terms of probably legal authority. So in the military and also in the service, I have legal authorities that, are impressed by the state. Mm-hmm. So as they say, you know, the state has the sword to actually gain compliance if people won't cooperate. So that's one big difference. In a church, in a sense, the authority is provided by God. So it's certainly not something to be disregarded, since it could have very much ultimate outcomes. But at the same time, if a person decides they're going to deny the authority, there aren't any, there is no
special court martial.
Yeah, there's no special court martial. There's no police that's going to come arrest you out of the church and make you do what the elders say. I mean, clearly that's not how it operates there. Right. It's cooperative from that standpoint. It's voluntary that you submit yourself to God. So that's much different, I would say, than both the military or even what I do in the Secret Service.
Right, which is interesting because the Bible does use military language about being a Christian.
Yes,
right?
It does.
We are, I mean, it uses farmer language too, and lots of language it uses. But we are soldiers of a type, but there's still a difference in the approach to the authority of the institutional church.
And much different too, because Jesus was very clear that our kingdom isn't here. As opposed to the state's kingdom per se, as much as it is a kingdom, does exist here in this time and in space and place.
Sure. And I want to come back to that, but we should swerve into talking about your current job as director of the Secret Service. How did you end up being director? I mean, we know that the president appointed you, but can you sort of walk us through the
leadership? Sure. So I was working. I retired from the military in 2011. Okay, and we moved back to Washington, D.C., which was the most likely area to find work for retired military officers. And I took a job at U.S. Customs and Border Protection in an area called Air and Marine Operations. So it's the part of CBP, Customs and Border Protection, that runs the aircraft and also all the watercraft that patrol the borders and also do a lot of operations internally in supporting immigration and customs enforcement inside the United States. So I took that, I got that job, I took that as a deputy, and then I became what's called the assistant commissioner in that job, and I was running the Air and Marine Operations there for about 4 years. I moved from that position to what's called Enterprise Services, which is the part of CBP that does all your kind of support, human resources, financial, information technology, facilities, training, all that fell in the enterprise services area. I worked that for only a few months until the administration changed. Now at CBP, the commissioner is a political appointee that's aligned to the presidency. So when the president leaves, he leaves. So on January 20th, you know, he didn't come to work anymore, and the deputy commissioner became the acting commissioner, and I became the deputy commissioner. And so I was there at CBP working for those 3 or 4 months. At that time, they brought in John Kelly. General John Kelly retired. I had retired out of Southcom. He came in as the Secretary of Homeland Security, and I had worked for him in Iraq. I mentioned the MEF commander was General Kelly, so he knew me. And the Secret Service had experienced a series of issues over the years that they were struggling with. The current director, Joe Clancy, was doing a good job, but he had basically been brought in, the idea in his mind, he didn't want to stay long term. He had served an entire career in the Secret Service, had retired, had a job post Secret Service, was looking to go back to that. So he stayed for several months after the administration turned over, and then he tendered his resignation. So at that point, General Kelly asked me to take the job, which was quite a surprise, since I have I had some law enforcement background on the CBP side, but nothing to do with what the Secret Service mission is in terms of protection or financial crimes, no expertise there at all. So from that standpoint, it was a steep climb.
And you're I was reading about this, you are the first director of the Secret Service in a while who's had no previous experience.
Right,
the
it was the 40s, was 1940s was the last time they had a non-agent or an outsider brought into the agency. Before that, before those years, it was frequent.
Right.
Because you didn't have the kind of the same, you know, expertise built up in those years.
Right.
But since the 40s on, it had always been somebody from the service that had been a director, which I think is actually a good policy. It's better to, I think, to train your own leadership,
right,
which is one of the primary things I'm working on as a director, is trying to get the leadership training of the agency in a better situation. We have more of a culture of leadership. People talk about cultures, you know, of learning or leadership or, you know, in Christian senses, discipleship or evangelism. So creating that culture of leadership is one of my jobs.
And what I want to ask you what specifically you're doing with that. But first, what does the Secret Service do overall? We should,
so
again, people get that from TV. So
yeah, so so what most people see on TV, I have to laugh, sorry, is they see us protecting the president.
Sure.
And that's the most visible posture of the Secret Service. And that is one of our primary mission sets. But it's not the only mission set. It's not where we put the bulk of our work. So most of our work goes into financial crimes. That was why the service was created in 1865. One of the last acts done by Abraham Lincoln was to authorize the creation of a unit in the government to combat counterfeiting, which at that time represented close to 40% of our currency. It was actually causing serious problems for the U.S. financial, for the U.S. financial markets and our financial structure. So that's why it was created. So the legacy of the service over the years has moved from counterfeiting more into electronic crimes, which is where the bulk of our transactions now occur. But most of the hours that we do in the Secret Service are in the investigative financial crimes area, and then a smaller portion of those actually go into protection. So now people associate us just with protection. That's actually not the bulk of our work.
Right, and the financial crimes side of things doesn't make the news. You know, when a high-profile celebrity says something threatening about the president,
right,
we all see that in the news. When you know someone counterfeits a $20 bill,
true. Well, the other aspect I would just say for the Secret Service is we deliberately do not expose companies to publicity. Okay, so we are trying to work on financial crimes, and until that crime actually appears in court, we are not of the habit of revealing who we are working with. So we worked with a number of industries, which I could name and won't.
Right.
That you would all recognize their names who have had fraud issues, but we don't advertise those because we want them to come to us, and they won't if they feel like they're going to immediately appear in the news.
Now, you and I were talking about this last night. You said that counterfeiting is actually declined as a major crime. Can
right.
you talk about that a little bit?
So, yes. Yeah, so counterfeiting, you know, at one time was one of the biggest parts of our work, but over the years, as you recognize, I mean, all, you know, your money's not in your wallet anymore. It just isn't. It's in an electronic bank account. And, of course, that's where the vast majority of crime is now occurring. So counterfeiting does occur, and it's easy to counterfeit because you can print a bill on an inkjet or a laser jet printer that is of decent quality. It'll have a lot of, now that I know currency so well, I can spot it pretty quick because it won't have a lot of the security features in the bill.
Right.
But so what we typically find is more mom and pop inside the United States. Hey, I need some money, so I'll go ahead and print off a couple $1,000s on my printer, and hopefully I won't get caught.
Right.
Okay, and so consequently, we find it mostly low level. The big operations that used to occur in the U.S., where you had big offset printing presses that were printing out millions and millions of dollars of currency, we don't see that in the U.S. anymore. That's all moved overseas, and even that's fairly rare. And partly because if you think about it, what's the largest denomination bill you have? $100. So it's hard to rack up a lot of money printing $100 bills when you can literally move a million or 2 million or $10 million all at once electronically and get your hands on it and defraud the company of that kind of a money.
Right.
So as I mentioned, in one recent instance, we had a a chain of hotels who lost $9 million in 3 days. Now, we got $6 million of those dollars back because they called us promptly and we were able to freeze all those transactions through the Treasury Financial Crime Center and the banks. But it moves in a hurry, and it follows a very common route from getting it out of your bank account into another bank account, moving it overseas, converting it into a cryptocurrency, then moving it to Eastern Europe, East Asia, Africa, and then converting it back to a fiat currency and you know, spending it that way.
Right.
And once it moves out of the country, then it's very hard for us to get our hands on it.
Sure, and that makes sense.
Right.
And I suppose it just shows where I'm at on the socioeconomic level, where I think, you know, $6 million, if I were a counterfeiter, I would be perfectly happy with way less than that. But that sounds like a lot of money.
Yeah, well, sadly, it's actually, as I look at cyber crime, it's interesting to see how much effort they put into it. And just recognition, it's like if they put half that effort into legitimate work, they would have a legitimate stream of income.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, that's a lot of crime. People who make math. I mean, if they were work as a chemist somewhere, you know, they'd blow themselves up less, I suppose. And anyway, so you come into the Secret Service, which has some problems. I don't want to ask you to go into detail on those, but
right.
Can you give us sort of broad strokes, like what were some of the struggles, and then what steps have you been taking to move the Secret Service in a good direction?
So, I mean, there's no secrets here. I've said this all to all my the agency itself, so it's not a secret. So part of it was how they structured and ran the agency. So a lot of your areas, like your chief information officer, your chief human capital officer, your chief financial officer, you know, they were all special agents. Well, they're not. So special agents are trained in financial crime, not financial controls. So that caused the service a lot of problems in constructing programs and actually making them execute correctly. And in the government, if your programs don't work, if they put money in them and it doesn't get spent, or it doesn't get spent wisely, you don't get the money again next year. So that was one of the issues there, was actually professionalizing parts of the service that we had. You know, for instance, the current chief information officer was the chief information officer for the U.S. Marine Corps before he retired. So he spent years and years and years working in that area. The lady who's our chief human capital officer has spent years at the Department of Defense working on human resources issues and was a senior executive over there. Our financial officer likewise has years of experience in the financial areas. And so they're able to run those parts of the agency very effectively. So that was one problem for the agency because it affected how much money we got because the programs didn't execute well. And then another part of it was in terms of leadership. And this should not be to say that all the leadership in the Secret Service is bad, but, you know, I did not find what I'll call a culture of leadership in the organization. So that's one of been my big efforts to develop that more fully. And so as I looked at our training was very, there wasn't much of it is the way to say it. There was only one level of training. It was for a first-line supervisor. So in the service, you have basically your basic special agents, then you have, you know, your what's called your assistants, or your assistant to the special agent, assistant special agent, deputy special agent in charge, special agent in charge. You have all these different gradations of special agents, and as they go up, they have more authority. Well, there was nothing to train these guys in their responsibilities. So someone who is a special agent in charge running a field office, his responsibilities are much different than an agent who's working cases. You know, how he has to run the office, decide where they're going to put their efforts, get resources, worry about facilities, human resources, all the stuff that comes with basically being a higher level manager. Well, there was no real way to teach folks on how to do that. And so the same thing applied as I looked at our uniform division, which guards the White House and the Vice President's residence. The same thing, they get trained as a sergeant, but as they moved up the ladder, lieutenant, captain, you know, deputy chief, no real training there, and it doesn't really help them execute their responsibilities. So that's one aspect of it, is the actual training was not there. So we're developing that. And then the second aspect is, well, you know, you can read about leadership and you can learn something, but actually learning how to do it, you have to, it's a hands-on experience. So how you mentor people in their actual capacity is the second part of this that we're focusing on too. And then the last part of this is how we select leaders. So we've had some issues in terms of who we select for leadership, and so the current selection process we're revamping so that we get a more what I'll call blind process. Okay, I want to avoid the propensity in any industry you work in is to pick your friends because you know them, but you only know your friend in one aspect. You don't know them from all sides. So we're trying to develop more of a system that allows us to see all sides of the person as we pick them for leadership.
If you'll let me, I do want to ask you, listeners of the show will know that I have serious reservations about Donald Trump, even as I have some respect for some of the things he's done, certainly, and certainly the people that he's put in various offices,
right.
Judges and director of the Secret Service and so on. What is your experience working for President Trump? I won't ask you your political thoughts on him because, again, I think that would be inappropriate, but can you talk about kind of your interactions with him at all?
Sure. So from our standpoint, actually protecting him is quite easy. He very much listens to the special agent that runs his detail. He understands the security risks. Sometimes presidents don't do that. They think they're somehow that their personality will somehow warm everybody and they won't be threatened. I think Mexico is currently watching to see how this works out with their president, who has declined his former protective detail. Now he has unarmed people doing that. So we'll see how that works. But generally, given what we know about threats towards the president, they are significant. It doesn't matter who the president is. They're on about a decade-long norm, I would just mention. So President Trump, from that standpoint, is easy to work with and easy to keep in the protective posture we need. And there are almost continuous threats, probably about two or three death threats a day is what he gets. So certainly we take that very seriously. In terms of how he's interacted with us in the service has been good. I have no issues there. He came out to our Raleigh Training Center to see the operations we do out there. So I think that's been good from that standpoint. He supported us in terms of our resourcing needs, which need to increase. They've been at a level that's not sustainable for the service for a number of years. So he's been good from that standpoint. And I would just say my personal interaction with him is fine. I really don't. They're good from that standpoint.
I had a question. In terms of death threats against the president, has that stayed stable with the transition from Obama to Trump? Are there more now? Or are there fewer now?
No, they are about a 10-year average.
Okay.
So the main increase in threats revolves around the increasing use of social media.
Right.
So there's more. So a person might make a threat before. You'd never hear about it just because, it's
right.
No way to get it out. So now a lot of it gets posted on social media. So that tends to elevate that. But that's a consistent theme between the Obama and the Trump administrations. So the actual amount of threats has been consistent, about a 10-year norm. And frankly, most of the people that threaten the president, are not serious about it. We will investigate any threat against the president. It doesn't matter who makes it, whether they're in politics or working in Hollywood, or they're just an average citizen. It doesn't matter to us. The president's protected by statute, and so we will investigate those. And in 99% of the cases, the people are going to recant of the threat. They don't really mean it.
Right.
Some people think it's their First Amendment right to threaten to kill the president. It's not. It definitely is not.
Right. Threaten to kill anyone. Right?
Yeah, really to threaten to kill anyone, and people seem to think that they have artistic license to do that, and they don't. That's not, the First Amendment doesn't protect that kind of speech.
Sure.
So I would just say that's a consistent theme across the 10 years. And the other part of this is, sadly, a lot of these threats come from mentally ill and unstable people, which are of great concern to us. If you remember, the last assassination attempt was by someone who was mentally unstable. He actually was not convicted of the crime. He was institutionalized.
This is Hinckley?
This is Hinckley. That's
who's
correct.
Who's out now, right?
Who is now out. That's correct. And is now out and under supervision. And we do actually keep track of him.
Sure. Sure.
That's the field officer's responsibility to keep track of what he's doing, where he's going, those kinds of things. But again, they're dangerous because they're unpredictable.
Right.
And if you get weapons in their hands, as you've seen in school shootings or other situations here, it's just a very dangerous situation. We very carefully manage that risk.
Sure. And well, here we are spending our time talking about that when you've said that's not the bulk of what you do. But again, it's what people people know.
Understand.
I don't promise not to play a clip from In the Line of Fire at some point during this episode.
Okay.
So in terms of these threats, which the response from you guys, as you've said, is generally very measured, right? You investigate, and then in general, nothing, like there's no follow. There's nothing beyond that because the threat's not a serious one. How many serious threats are there? If I'm allowed to ask.
So maybe a couple of times a month we will, and that may be excessive. I'll just say, let's say once a month, we're going to have a threat that's serious enough that we're going to engage the U.S. attorney and ask for charges to be preferred,
okay.
Which does happen on a fairly regular basis. It's not all that often, but occasionally it does rise to that level where they're serious about the threat they're making, and we will actually prefer charges against them under Title 18.
Right. And so once a month or so is serious. And again, that's kind of a standard since the Obama administration.
Right. Well, even the average number of threats per day, three per day, and the what we call directions of interest, which are hundreds a week, have been fairly consistent between the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations. And so I just should mention, so that's a low number of cases we actually ask the U.S. attorney to prosecute or actually bring charges against, because the U.S. attorney is the one who does all this charging, not us.
Right.
We just bring the evidence in the case to him. But I would mention that we take a very active posture in terms of managing those people we know have made threats and are potential threats to the president. That's what we call managed risk. So if we have a person that, typically they are mentally ill, that has a direction of interest towards the president or has threatened the president or is trying to come to the White House to see the president, we engage the field office of where that person lives. So in this area, let's say it was somebody in Bolivar, the Springfield field office would manage that person, and they would engage all the people that surround that person, pastors, church, mental health professionals, medical, law enforcement, friends, family, everybody we try to wrap into this process, because in most cases, those people don't want this person to become involved in the crime.
Right.
So it's what we call managed risk, and it's the job of the field office to manage those people and make sure that, we're not having issues with them.
Right.
And it seems to be effective from that standpoint. We're able, more than not, to keep them from traveling to the White House to do foolish things, or if they do come, we're told in advance, hey, so-and-so has left home and is traveling to the White House, and so we know to look for them.
Yeah, and that was actually one of the first things you had to deal with, right, as Secret Service Director, was the guy who jumped into the White House.
Right, yeah, yes.
Our listeners might remember that big story at the time.
Right, they probably do. So we've taken some additional measures in terms of how we're actually securing the White House now to give the officers that guard it some more space to actually operate.
Right.
So one of the problems that we had in at that time is you have a fence. The fence is not very tall.
No, it's
not that hard to get over it. And so we've actually created a zone in front of that if you cross into that zone, you'll be arrested. So that's helped significantly in keeping people from getting over the fence. Plus, the just general posture of alertness has been increased, too.
Right. Well, I want to wrap up, and thank you for taking time to do this. I want to wrap up once again with this question of leadership. Now from the perspective as an administrator of a bureaucracy or a branch of the bureaucracy, and sort of comparing and contrasting again to the point of authority that most Christians are going to run into with being an elder. What are there similarities between what you do as the head of the Secret Service and what you would do as an elder? Or again, are those such completely different jobs that there's no go-between?
You know what, I actually would say no. I would say there are similarities because, really as you lead people, you are influencing them, okay? That's primarily what you do in leadership. People view kind of leadership in the military as the drill sergeant yelling at his troops, right? Okay,
sure.
Well, even in the military at more senior levels, it doesn't look like that. In the same way in the Secret Service, though you have those levels of authority, that's not typically how they're exercised. And so in that standpoint, I'd say it's very similar from the standpoint that you're influencing people to try to attain certain actions, okay? There's different aspects to it. As an elder in the church, it's a shepherding response. The elder is called not to lord it over his the people that he's shepherding, So it's a different approach from that standpoint. But I find even in just the Secret Service or the Marine Corps, that approach works much better than just, you know, I'm going to yell at somebody or, you know, I'm going to, you know, have all this pomp and circumstance surrounding me. It's just people, particularly Americans, just don't appreciate that. They want a more cooperative leadership style, which in some ways looks not exactly like the church, but has some similarities to it.
Sure. Yeah, and that, I mean, that makes sense too, that leading by example and by instruction rather than by command and by bullying.
Yeah, even the society is imbibed, you know, the servant leadership idea, which is what Jesus did. Okay, they try to pick that up. There's probably some problems with how they approach that, but you know, the fact is that was the model he used. Is, you know, he led by serving, and he led very effectively in that way.
So anything you'd like our listeners to know in conclusion, and you can pick your topic. We've covered the range. You can do customs and border protection. You can do Secret Service, military, being an elder, all of the above. What do you think our listeners most need to know about any or all of those topics?
Well, one thing I would just remark, I would just make this final comment in terms of leadership, and this applies really across the spectrum and wherever you do it, and this is the idea that is talked about in the Bible. If you want to lead effectively, you have to love the people that you're leading. If you don't care about them, they will figure it out, okay, and that will profoundly impact your ability to lead them in the direction you're taking them. So that would be what I would offer as a kind of a closing remark on it.
Well, with that, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, listener, for tuning in. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.